For more on the psychology behind the phenomena of witchcraft superstition, we turn to our resident Dr. Professor Luke Galen for this episode's installment of God Thinks Like You.
We're going to call it Witch Thinks Like You, and then it'll lead to an Abbott and Costello routine. Witch Thinks Like You. Witch Thinks Like You.
Who? The World Health Organization? No, they don't think like you.
Witch. Certainly not. In episode 69, the listeners might remember we covered a similar thing with witches, and you've probably heard that a lot of these beliefs fit a similar template. In fact, there's like a whole sociology of witches. You can take entire courses, semesters of things like, you know, the history of witchcraft and that, where they tie it into basically, you know, social causes about why marginalized people, often women, on the community, like, you know, the Salem witch trials and fits a profile. And in Europe, when there was the witch scare, there seems to be specific people that are designated as problems, and then the religion part takes over. But what I think is interesting is to strip it down even further into the psychological bedrock of why people seek out causes or seek to blame phenomena like floods or disasters or sick children, the village being, you know, having misfortune. Why is it that we tend to designate causes of that are often other people? So another phenomenon that's similar to the witchcraft accusation thing is the evil eye. I don't know if – I don't remember ever talking about this on the show before.
This is fascinating. I don't – we haven't talked about it, and I didn't even – I just thought that was like a when somebody's glaring at you. Yeah. I just thought that was what the evil eye was.
It's not
I didn't
really
know
part
it
of our
was
culture.
A whole superstitious thing built around it.
Yeah, it's not really part of our culture. One of my students, though, is from the Middle East, Palestine, and she had this thing on her keychain that I always noticed. Like, what is that? It's like a blue background with a circle in the middle. And she's like, it's the evil eye, obviously. You know, it's like we have – it's all over the place.
Obviously.
Or it's a charm to ward off the evil eye. And so, you know, when I started poking around on this, and this – the Middle East, the Balkans, and Asia, this is a very common folk belief that, and it corresponds to, there seems to be an intuition that if you have good luck or fortune, that don't be too proud about it or talk about it because other people will give you the evil eye. And so you have amulets and charms that you do, like you rub or you hang up, so that you don't, what we would say is that you don't jinx it.
There seems to be a whole industry around this, even in a article by Massimo Pilidoro in Skeptical Inquirer.
Skeptical Inquirer.
He mentioned this Italian TV personality, Juana Marchi, who made $32 million, or actually in American dollars, $43 million, just selling people protections from the evil eye.
Yeah, a lot of there's a cottage industry, and like I guess you could call them good witch sorcery, that protects you from the evil eye. But it all seems to be linked to this notion that you don't – that, and especially in like these communities where there's a tight-knit community, often marginal, poor, you don't want to be too uppity. Otherwise, somebody's going to take you down a peg. That is that they might want your new stuff or your brand-new hut or whatever. And so you don't even want to compliment your own kids or say my kids are good-looking or my wife's good-looking because when you jinx it, it's going to invite – there seems to be this impression of a social jealousy, envy phenomena that you would invite by talking too much about it or by being too proud.
And that's supernaturalized into some sort of force from the glare itself?
Yeah. So the eye aspect is that there seems to be that analogy, the metaphor is that the envy comes through the gaze. So think about in the Bible, like all these prohibitions against coveting. What's the big deal about coveting? Should that be that much of a problem that I like my neighbor's stuff, his ass especially? But and there seems to be a recognition in those rules that the coveting –
I covet my neighbor's ass.
There's a recognition that the envy itself is toxic in a close-knit community like that. You don't want to invite other people's sense that you're better than them. But what's interesting is that the opposite intuition holds true because it's almost axiomatic. If something bad did happen to me, especially like after I've been trying to, you know, work hard and get stuff, it must have been because somebody took it from me. I invited the evil eye. Somebody hexed me. So in other words, that people assume that if a misfortune occurs, they perhaps brought it on themselves, or somebody else in the community did it to them because they were envious and jealous of them and wanted to hex them. And you might think, well, how do you, you know, that seems to be fairly esoteric. How would you research that? But there's actually some empirical studies where it's specifically people take actions because they seem to recognize that if there are other people giving them bad sorts of envy, you want to placate them by doing something friendly or pro-social so that, yeah, I just won the lottery, but I'm really a generous person. I'm going to buy everybody this stuff. In fact, in some of these communities, this Ebola outbreak has been going on. A lot of the beliefs work against development in the communities because nobody wants to be too successful.
Yeah.
And if you do, sometimes it's more of a burden because then you have to buy your neighbor the thing and you have to get your cousin the thing and these people come out of the woodwork. And if you don't get it for them, you're viewed as being not a team player or as being stingy.
One of these articles you're about to talk about in a moment talked about Polynesian fishers. They were studied in the 1940s. One Western observer noticed that when a fisherman caught a fish but the others didn't, he would throw his fish back. Because if he didn't, everybody else would be talking about him negatively at the village. And they even had a concept in their language for this. It was called Tepe Te Kiamo, the blocking of envy.
If you've ever had Anthropology 101, that a lot of the native cultures have this potlatch ceremony where you throw a party and give all your crap away to everybody else. In fact, the big man of the village was the guy who gave away the most stuff. And sometimes this became problematic because it led to a competition to give all your crap away. And you could see how it could be almost a burden, like, oh, Jesus, I just killed, a hog. I have to feed everybody. Right. You almost would rather not.
Yeah, you almost don't want success in that scenario.
Well,
But as far as going being more pro-social then, if you're successful, something good happens to you and you're afraid people are going to be envious, I think the key point is they don't become generally more pro-social.
Nope.
They become only more pro-social towards those who could possibly affect them negatively through their envy.
Yeah, the empirical studies, the lead authors Van der Ven, and their study was called Warding Off the Evil Eye, when the fear of being envied increases pro-social behavior. What they did was, you're correct, they had a bunch of different scenarios to try to weed out these other interpretations, like the one you mentioned would be a noblesse oblige. Like maybe people are just in general generous when they have good fortune to people
good
who don't have it.
I'm going
to
give back.
But when they messed with the conditions a bit, they found out that it wasn't just any old benign envy or like giving it to the poor person that motivated the pro-social behavior. It was specifically when the people were afraid of being maliciously envied. That is, when they thought the other person might actually do something about it or didn't like them because they were of different statuses, that motivated the behavior to be pro-social, like helping them or whatever like that.
Right. So their successes are, in a sense, a liability. A social liability.
Well, you can view it as being think of this from an evolutionary perspective. It serves a group function to tamp down any sort of dissent that if somebody is successful, you worry a little bit about other people envying that. And you want to calm the waters before there could be any dissension by saying, oh, I'll give you this and I'll give you that.
Mm-hmm. But yet benign envy is a good thing. You know, benign envy inspires people to improve their own situation. So I see Justin's looking rather ripped today. I want to go to the gym more often or something like that. I'm just making that up.
You know, to the listeners, we will post the pictures on the website.
I am a twig.
We have a growing fan base that now apparently sexually objectifies Justin Schieber now.
That's not true.
He's inviting malicious envy from me.
I've seen it.
I used to be the pretty boy, and now it's him. Anyway, so this is where you get the this to go back to the witches. Witches, if you want to think about it, are the mechanism of this delivering of hexing or the envy embodied into people like that. Because people would assume, let's say you get your new cow or you fix up your hut and then it burns down and the cow sours or whatever. The intuition seems to be, who did this in my immediate group? They must have looked at me with envy, and let's designate a causal agent there. It must have been a witch. So that's where you see in these sociological studies a lot of the identification of witchcraft as a group contagion, a witch hunt. That's where you hunt down people that are presumed to be responsible for misfortune. Mm-hmm. Because the intuition is somebody must be responsible. It just can't be random. You know, lightning bolts don't just come from the sky. And so this gets into the second part of what I wanted to talk about. And this is something I was thinking about introducing for a long time because it's a very interesting theory, but it's called moral typecasting theory. Typecasting, meaning that just like in the drama industry, certain people become associated with types of roles that they might find it very difficult to not be seen as that role. You know, when you cast Leonard Nimoy, you're getting Spock. He's not like Mel Gibson. Let that sink in.
Anyway,
but moral typecasting theory merges together other things that I've talked about in this show with things that are very low-level psychological processes, like theory of mind, for example, why we attribute that other people might have mental qualities as opposed to a rock, you know, that you're somebody with independent thoughts. But it also links together that moral typecasting is that the things that elicit these attributions about mind are specifically moral situations, situations with a moral component like a flood where somebody was killed, not just my toast got burned, or fortune, like, you know, I just won the lottery as opposed to, you know, I just found a parking space. So what moral typecasting theory is, it combines a lot of this stuff into the central hypothesis is that we assume that in any given situation that has a moral connotation, there must be an agent that intended that, that has minds. It's not just random stuff. If something happened that have of great moral importance, it was intended. There must be an intentional agent. And so the typecasting part, though, comes in that we basically have a two-dimensional, two different axes, if you can picture that in two-dimensional space, of either on one axis, the agent's ability to experience things. So like to suffer or to think about something. A high experiencer would be somebody who can feel and be conscious, as opposed to at the other end, low experience would be like a rock. There's no, yeah. There's no mental activity. Crossed with the other dimension of agency or activity, things do things. So a high agent is somebody who's like, you know, us basically, we have intentions, we do things. A low agent would be helpless, like a baby or a robot or a, well, I guess robots could be moderate.
Yeah, or they were kind of middle.
A vegetative person would be a low agency.
A dog might be low agency.
So this theory that's advanced by the late Daniel Wegener from Harvard University, and then one of his students, Gray, but they have this theory that these two-dimensional aspects lead to typecasting because, and here's where the religious connection comes in, they found, oddly enough, that God seems to be all agency and no experience. That when people think about what God does, it's he, you know, smites or benefits or grants boons, but he doesn't feel anything.
I thought that was the strangest thing of the study, but they seem to back it up pretty well experimentally. They asked these questions, right, and they split them into attributes of experience versus attributes of agency.
Yeah.
And yeah, they found pretty consistently people view God as hyper in control and doing everything, but almost not at all. They didn't attribute emotional experiences to him at all, which really cuts across the grain of my experience.
Mm. Yeah.
But the respondents to this, it was a significant number. It was in the thousands, I think.
Well, there's a bunch of different studies that they combined. And you could actually, if you Google this, you could probably see their little image of the two-dimensional model there and the different axes. And they show things like, you know, your attributed agency and experience to you is we're high on both. I perceive myself as both experiencing and acting. The opposite of both would be inanimate objects. So a low experiencer and a low agent would be like a rock or something like that. But yes, so they also had things like, does a vegetative person experience things or an embryo or whatever? And those people were high on you know, experience, but low on agency. That is, they didn't do anything, but they had the capacity to suffer. So here's where the typecasting comes in, though, is that is, why would God be attributed low experience? Because in many situations, he's the moral author. He's the agent that does the doing. And because of that, we diminish his mental capacity to experience things, to suffer. And even not just God, but also things like Jesus, the saints, witches. Since they're authors of moral consequence, they can't also be sufferers of other people's actions.
And this was based on a distinction they made in the theory between the agent and the patient.
Yeah, in any given situation.
The patient is the recipient of harm or benefit, and the agent, right, doles out the harm or benefit. And they said that the way we typically think, part of this typecasting is that we mostly see somebody in one role or the other.
In any given situation.
So if the patient, if you are receiving harm or benefit, you can't be the agent. The reverse with God is, since God is doing is so robust in his agency, yes, he must not be a patient in any sort of way. And so we this somehow explains the reason why we don't attribute emotions to God. But maybe that's why where I got a little confused.
Think of it situational, though. In any given play, you can't play the same role. In fact, we think it's remarkable when characters are evil but also suffer, like Walter White or something like that. It sets up a conflict. Is he a victim or is he an agent?
Yeah, we tend to want to see one of those as more dominant.
Right, and so where it comes to situations like we've been talking about here, where you have why would somebody generate a just world theory or a witch? Why can't you just say stuff happens, it's just random? There seems to be it sets up an intuition that if there is a moral patient, somebody who suffered, let's say, there must have been an agent who caused that suffering. There must have been, because there's no way that you can have just one thing, one patient, without an agent. And so we seek to find one. You're the witch. You must have been the agent, the cause of Justin's suffering. Yeah. If he's suffering, you must have done it.
We always complete in the other side.
We fill it in because otherwise it's an unbalanced dyad. And it works the other direction, too. And here's what I think is creative about this theory. This dyadic structure of morality means that any isolated, either an agent or a patient, somebody who suffers, it compels people to complete that moral dyad by inferring the presence of that complementary type. And so this is what explains actually a lot, because it explains why people who think that – who generate harm from situations that you and I might not think is harmful. If you've determined already – people often have the opposite thing. Like people first come to the conclusion that abortion's harmful. And then they think about it, or like marijuana must cause some problem. But it's actually – this theory would say it's the other way around. You first have a moral reaction to it. Yuck. I don't like pot smokers. I don't like abortion. I don't like gays kissing and getting married. Then you fill in, well, there must be a harm. I'm going to find it. Yeah. And then you generate all these other things. Mm. Those things that they say are harmful about abortion, pot smoking, gays kissing were generated after they had the moral reaction. Mm. And they obviously don't want to think of it that way, that they want to talk the other way, that I've determined through my research that gay marriage is harmful or that pot smoking causes problems. Therefore, my moral reaction is based on that, but it's not. It's the opposite. Yuck first, then there must be a harm because I don't like it. It's a moral action, so therefore it's harmful.
They have an immoral agent, and they're trying to find the patient who's been given harm, basically, completing the dyad. Now, so this is all really theory-driven, this stuff. What kind of empirical support do we have for this?
Yeah, so they did a series of studies ranging from, like, on one hand, the correlational. One thing that we've talked about in the show before is why does religion seem to thrive in harmful environments or, the environments, places that suck, basically. They would say that religionist belief is higher in things like countries or states where there's suffering because people generate agents to account for the suffering. The Swedes do not need to have anthropomorphized gods because their life is pretty good. And there's no suffering to complete that dyad. So that's on a correlational level. That fits in with it. But they've done experiments where they've varied things like, a scenario where people are having a picnic and then there's a flood, and the flood can either be very benign, like it just ruined their lunch, or disastrous, the family was killed or something like that. And then what caused the flood? They had variations here. It was a malevolent dam worker who deliberately did this, or unclear. Where you get the God attribution is in the combination of two things: great harm, family died, and then unknown cause. So if I have somebody specifically already that's an obvious cause of it, I don't invoke a God explanation. I know why it happened. Mm-hmm. It was the guy who did it. But if it's unclear what caused something, and let's face it, a lot of the things that you see witch attributions are is like, cancer, sickness, whatever. It's unclear what caused it and of great harmfulness or great moral import. Mm-hmm. So in the experiments, they found that this sort of attribution of mindfulness out there doing things, smiting things, it needed a particular combination of, it wasn't just my toast got burnt and therefore the witch did it. It had to be important and then ambiguous as to the cause. Also, good things too. So, things that get better when your tumor goes away. It's not often clear why that happened or whatever.
Though they did seem to indicate that we pay more attention to the negative in this.
Yeah,
that's a
classic negative bias because, even again, evolutionary-wise, you think about that, there's more benefit to look out for things that might hurt you to avoid rather than things that help you.
Yeah.
And there was a separate study that Wegner's team did, the lead author is Ward, where they actually looked at this whole notion of attributing mind to things that are usually thought of as mindless, vegetative patients or robots or things like that. Why would somebody think that it could harm you to pull the plug on you if you're brain dead? We sort of talked about this earlier. Or like, you know, could you hurt a robot? And what they found was is that, and here's the paradoxical aspect of this, if they give people scenarios like, let's say so-and-so's brain dead, they're not coming back, the machine's keeping them alive. Do they suffer if somebody would be like cruel to them, like poke them with something or, you know, shock them or cut their food off? It turns out that the scenarios in which the act was done intentionally, a malevolent nurse at the home where you the patient is.
So you know you have your agent.
There's an agent who did it on purpose. They attributed more mind to the victim when the harm was intentional as opposed to when it was unintentional. The plug, the power went out and so the machine turned off and then he starved.
They created a patient.
They created a mind that experiences when there was a deliberate harm but not when there was not deliberate harm.
That's what is really interesting about this as opposed – I mean we've talked a lot about our overactive agency detection. But we've usually looked at just that one aspect, you know, our ability to we want to see epic events being for some sort of purpose tied to some sort of agency. This is really interesting where we go in the opposite direction, where we can actually already have an agent and create a I guess you would say instead of agency detection, what we're looking here at is patient detection. We're overactively looking for a victim.
Yeah, the part of it does might seem to contradict what we've talked about before on the show of dehumanization literature, the tendency of if somebody suffers to think of them as less mindful, less capable of suffering. So like Jews were thought of as being like vermin in camps because the Nazis were making them suffer. This is different from that because that's those people already had some amount of mind to begin with. That is, if somebody already has the capability to feel – we do dehumanize them when they suffer, inconsistency with just world belief. That is, if something bad happens to you, you know, you must have deserved it, you scum, whatever. What this is suggesting is things that don't have any mind ordinarily, or you know, a rational person would say a robot that cannot feel pain, except if somebody intends to harm it. And then suddenly we attribute – we start to inflate that person – the victims, inflate their capacity to suffer because of the intentionality of the act.
If you're always looking at the agent and trying to, with theory of mind, predict what they're going to do, why would an agent attack or try to do harm to an inanimate object? It's almost like a kind of piece of evidence that that object must have some mind or feeling we're going to take the time to do something immoral to it.
I was trying to think of a time where I might have felt this intuition, and here's what I came up with. Have you ever seen the movie AI that came out about 10 years ago where the robots were – you know, in society are very sophisticated, but they didn't experience emotions unless you specifically activated the program that they did. Do you remember that there's a group of people that tormented robots? They seem to have like a demolition derby mentality where they blew them up and did stuff. I was thinking that if you had a robot in front of you where you accidentally – they accidentally got their arm ripped off by something like that, it wouldn't elicit for me an ouch response if nobody intended for that to happen. So like, you know, their arm gets lopped off by a thing, I'd be like, oh – are you okay? Yes, I am fine. But that scene where they were tormenting the robots on purpose, like the crowd was cheering and they were tearing them apart, did evoke an emotional reaction for me. Yeah. And I'm thinking, why would that be the case? Either way, the robots can't feel anything. They're just robots and they're just – they're like, oh, okay, my arm got ripped off.
See the sadistic intent.
The sadistic intent on the part of the person doing it matters when we attribute the suffering of the victim.
It makes it a moral thing and therefore we make the victim into a –
you complete something. The moral story, essentially.
Yeah. Basically, we fill in the other side of the dyad. So, yeah, that was really – that was interesting information to back that up. But so they did this with a corpse?
Corpses, robots, vegetative patients, people in these scenarios when they were evaluating them, they gave them more mental properties, not just unidimensional things, but they were capable of pain, hunger, you know, loneliness if the harm done to them was deliberate. So putting it together what we talked about with the other studies, there seems to be this dyadic structure in to tie it together with what we talked about with witches and the evil and things like that. If we seem to be set up to perceive actions as requiring an author an agent causing them if we perceive the outcome as being moral in consequence. So, you know, if my ox dies or my hut burns down in my village, we look for a responsible person because we find it very hard to understand why that would happen, since it's so important and a thing could happen without a cause, without a person causing it, an agent.
Yep. The whole idea of envy and the evil eye, we mentioned at the beginning this distinction between a kind of benevolent envy and malevolent envy. So benevolent envy just inspired people to improve their own lives, to get up to the same level as the person they're envious of, whereas the malevolent kind might inspire attacks, reprisals of some sort. The study noted that the thing that changes our envy from benevolent to malevolent is how deserving we thought the person was. If we thought that they deserved all the good things that happened to them, envy was more benevolent. If, on the other hand, we felt that it didn't, you know, we didn't deserve it at all, that person was just benefiting from the cosmos. It's attributed to something else.
Yeah, you see that difference culturally, too. I mean, like in America, we seem to be a little bit of an outlier, like capitalist countries, where the reason that we don't murder the rich in this country, we admire them, is because we see them as deserving, even in the face of all rationality. Yeah, if you won the lottery or the lottery of life, if you're born on third base and thought you hit a triple, we still think, oh, that person must have deserved it, which is perverse because we know that differences in wealth and success happen randomly. In other parts of the world, like let's say you might remember like in the UK back when things were pretty in recession in the 80s, like the punks and things like that, you did not want to be caught by a gang of punks because they resented successful people. If they saw, that's the difference between Britain and the United States then, is that if they saw a nice person driving a nice car, they'd want to steal your car and punch you for having that. In the United States, we want to be that person. You know, but there are other countries. We're the outlier. The more traditional societies, they do get resent, especially in close-knit communities. They do have this notion of, who do you think you are?
Right.
Rather than, oh, attaboy.
I think you're better than us. Yeah.
One thing to take away from this is that this is a very human impulse. This is tragic circumstances that this when this happens, but it's a very natural human impulse. It takes a lot of critical thinking and research to understand what's going on and to maybe stand back from it and view the situation more objectively. But then superstition and metaphysics comes in and turns these into real entities. This is the evil eye, or this is the witch's curse.
Well, I was thinking about that when we talk about some of the horrible things that can happen to these children or people designated as being witches. Like, how could somebody try to burn them alive or pound a nail into their head or whatever? If you think about it, if the intuition is that those people are witches, they're powerful. They can't suffer. They can't be a moral patient if they're a moral agent. If this child is thought to have killed my other kid, they can't really suffer that much. They don't have empathy for that person because
they're active. Wonders if there's a problem with this where, I mean, if you look at what they do to witches and to other undesirables, a lot of it seems to be torture activity that seems to be done to harm someone. In the sense, not just preventing the actor from acting, the agent from acting. You're actually trying to increase, their pain, essentially.
Yeah, there's this, in some of these articles, the authors talked about stories from like medieval Europe where if a pig caused the death of a person, you know, let's say the pig ate a kid in the night, or like a horse accidentally stumbled and crushed somebody, they would try them in court and then hang them, or like torment the animals to death or something like that to punish them. Whereas we would say, well, why are you – it's just a dumb animal. It didn't even intend to do that. But if the outcome was horrible, somebody died, they attributed that must have been intentional and that we have to make them suffer as well as just like it was an accident.
Yeah, I was not making that connection.
And I would imagine you would see that too with robots or your devices. If your device causes you a major thing, like loses your dissertation or, you know, drops your phone call and then your girlfriend breaks up with you, you would scream at it and say, what the hell, blah, blah, blah. You wouldn't just say, it's just a device.
Wait a second. I have been attributing agency to my devices for their moral wrongdoing.
Jeremy, you've been neglecting me. I can't find your document.
You've been praising your new technology as of recent, though.
Well, yes, I've been giving it moral status as an agent.
Well, if you want to see, actually, in all seriousness, if you want to see, like, the movie Her deals with some of those issues.
I want to see that.
Yeah.
So
what happens when you have a program or operating system that has basically is developing sentience? How would we react to that, and what sort of leeway would we give it in terms of what it wants or what she wants or whatever?
Yeah. Can't really say more without spoiling
it. Yeah, I don't want to know anything.
Well, that's going to do it for God Thinks Like You.